So welcome back to the show today, Daisy. Things seem to have calmed a little since we last spoke. Rishi Sunak, the now Prime Minister, has finalised his government. We've also seen a new budget, but there's been a lot of negative reception to the country entering another period of austerity, and many people have reacted negatively that other economic ideas are not being discussed. You've described the Chancellor's work as a chaos budget. So what would the Liberal Democrats have done differently?
Well, it's a great question. I mean, to start with, it is a disastrous budget because what the government has decided to do is to, are having wasted millions, if not billions of pounds during the mini budget. They're now asking every single person in this country to pay more taxes. And the Independent Office of Budget Responsibility has said that this is going to be incredibly tough. And others have said that we're going to see the biggest drop in living standards on record ever. So these are really, really difficult times. What Liberal Democrats have called for, we called for a proper windfall tax on the big oil and gas companies, which we estimate that if they close various loopholes and raise the threshold, this could raise £60 billion over 3 years. We also called for the tax cuts for the banks to be reversed. We also called for Rishi Sunak to agree a proper global corporation tax agreement, which would raise a further £7 billion a year. All of these things would raise billions and billions of pounds, which could be spent on protecting our health and education budgets, on ensuring that people can get more help with their energy bills, and also setting up a mortgage protection fund, because even though everybody is struggling at the moment, including obviously renters, the people who lost out the most from the mini budget under Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng were people on the lowest, some of the people on the lowest incomes who do have a mortgage, and those people are looking to be potentially priced out of paying their mortgages and are at risk of losing their homes. And I think that is an unacceptable situation to be in through no fault of their own.
To add to this, one of the Liberal Democrats' ideas consistently through Brexit, after Brexit, has been as close a ties to the European Union as possible. You obviously want to re-enter, but would now be a time for maybe putting Brexit to the side? You know, we have seen muted discussions within Conservative Party, Labour, and obviously you're continuing to champion this, but at a time where the estimates are that Brexit has caused at least 50, maybe more, 100 billion, some estimates say, a loss in revenue, would now be the time to kind of discuss tighter relations with Europe rather than pushing away further?
Well, I certainly don't want to rerun the old arguments of the past, but I think everybody can agree that the current deal simply isn't working. And we've seen that, you know, businesses are being wrapped up in red tape. Doctors and nurses who we could have expected to come to this country haven't come. And therefore, the current deal simply isn't working and the government have screwed it up. So we do need to revisit the deal and build a closer deal with the European Union. Liberal Democrats have set out our position on Europe. We have a four-stage plan for building closer ties. That starts with rebuilding trust, which is going to take some time, but rebuilding trust with the EU and negotiating a better deal. Then looking to build closer relationships by joining some of their programmes, whether it's the Erasmus programme, the Erasmus scheme ET part of which was educational, or whether it's the science programmes and other research programmes. And then we want to start looking at improving our trade deals with other countries, because many of them have done huge damage to various industries in this country, including our farmers. And then the final stage at some point in the future would be to rejoin the single market so we can get the workers that we need to really pump prime our economy. That's our four-stage plan. It will take time, but right now we need to revisit the deal so we can, you know, try and improve those links and start cutting all the red tape that the Conservatives have introduced.
The focus at the moment, as you've discussed there as well, in terms of what the Liberal Democrats would have done differently, is filling this so-called black hole. But what also would be the movements towards investment in the future? Because we're seeing Maybe the evidence of 12 years of underinvestment in certain public services. And quite often, when businesses invest in certain areas, they look at the stock of the quality of the individuals, you know, the workers. And that can be related to their education, but also their health quality and things like that. Would you be proposing, instead of cutbacks, investment in education, health, and other things that would improve the lives of people as a whole?
Well, the first thing we've got to do is we have got to focus on growth because our economy is not growing. And the way to achieve growth, and particularly the way that we want to achieve growth, first of all, to invest in people. We have got to invest in skills and education so that individuals can move into the jobs of the future and so that we can become a competitive place for companies to move to and invest. So we've got to invest in skills and education, first of all. The second thing to do is to invest in our high streets. You know, we're a country of small businesses, and yet our small businesses, particularly those on our high streets, are getting absolutely strangled, including by this broken business rate system, which I've campaigned on for years. So we've got to save our high streets. We've got to start investing and attracting businesses into the country to produce the new green tech jobs of the future. And we've got to reduce the trade tensions with other trading blocs, including the European Union. So those are four ways in which Liberal Democrats would like to pump prime our economy and get growth going again.
One of the issues that is linked to this and that you've been particularly vocal about, this is one of the areas that you cover in Parliament, is the crisis within the NHS. You recently described the problems as from absurd pension rules to expensive visas. The Conservatives are strangling our pipeline of NHS staff with red tape. The Liberal Democrats as a whole have responded with ideas to the crisis in the NHS by stating that you'd ensure a legal right to see a GP within a week and 24 hours within emergency, a 24/7 booking line that you can make an appointment and boost the workforce by about 8,000 with increasing training places for GPs and medical schools across the country. How would all this be achieved?
Well, first things first, in terms of GPs, we want to increase training places because there are people applying to go to medical school, and the government has managed to put a cap in place that limits the number of students. So first of all, we've got to increase the number of students that can actually train. And then once you've got people training to become medics, we need to encourage them to go into general practice in the first place. I think there probably needs to be some reform of the general practice contract because I think for many new people coming into the sector, the practice model in itself is not always very attractive. So there probably is some reform, and we need to show that there can be career development and career progression within that particular route. I think we also need to free up the time of general practitioners. You know, it's always been the case historically that general practitioners sort of do primary care, but increasingly they're doing secondary care, which is to look after patients with long-term conditions. And if we want our GPs to focus, as they have to, increasingly on that area of work, then we should be looking to other people, whether it's nurses or pharmacists, to take on some more prescribing rights. Because ultimately, in pharmacists, it's their job to prescribe drugs, and so there's no reason why they couldn't be doing more of that. So there's many things that we could be doing to improve access to our GPs. And we've said that we'd like there to be 8,000 more GPs. We believe that would take about 4 years. So this plan that we have isn't something we can deliver overnight. We're being really upfront and honest about it. It will cost money as well. We think it will cost about £4 billion, and we think that we could fund that by closing a particular loophole which benefits the 0.5% wealthiest people in this country who have access to a particular loophole in capital gains tax. So we've got a plan in place. It would take 4 years, but if the government got on with it, you know, we could see it happening sooner than hopefully at some other point in the future.
Well, you've mentioned them already, nurses, but we've seen that they have voted to go on strike. You know, with the discussions around this, the government's offer was a 4% pay rise. You described this as an insult. So what pay rise would the Lib Dems offer as a fair pay deal?
Sure. Well, I think it really is for the government to come to this conclusion in the negotiations with nurses and their representatives. The fact is, offering a 4% pay deal when inflation is 11%, you know, really is an insult. And so I think the government is going to have to increase that offer. You know, I do support people's right to strike. But I don't think that strikes are the right solution. You know, I think we've got negotiations are the right thing to have right now. And what really concerns me most is that the government has been missing in action. We've heard time and time again from different sectors that the government and government ministers simply aren't turning up to the negotiating table. And that to me is completely unforgivable. I have been calling on the government repeatedly to step up to the task, to go into those negotiations, to sit around the table and get to a pay deal that actually prevents these strikes from going ahead. And, you know, unfortunately, the government just hasn't been listening and isn't taking it seriously enough.
So how would you pay for this? Because, again, this would come back to the whole point of if you're going to offer... you didn't say a specific number, but in terms of that, the 4% pay rise came out of the government's own independent body, which links it to the budget. So again, it would have to be a budgetary issue. So how would this increase for nurses be paid for?
Well, the issue we have at the moment is the government says that you have these independent pay bodies, but the government gives them the size of the envelope. So they say, this is how much money you've got to play with. And then within that, you can try and negotiate something with whoever it is, whether it's, you know, nurses or whether it's paramedics or whether it's, you know, train workers, whoever it might be. The government ties the hands of these bodies before they've even gone into the negotiating room. So what we have called for is a truly independent body that looks right across the public sector and makes recommendations across the board in an independent way that the government can then address. The issue we have is that, you know, there are different pay scales in every single sector, but there are some people who are really at the bottom of the pay scale, really need the most support right now, because not only is their pay not keeping up, but all of their bills are going through the roof. And if you just think about nurses in particular, you know, we have a really difficult situation where one in four hospitals now run food banks for their nurses and their hospital staff. You know, 2/3 of our nurses earn less than the national average salary in this country. Nurses are not being rewarded for the work that they do, and it should be no surprise that they are leaving the profession in their droves. If we are serious about having a decent health and social care service in this country, then we need to retain the workers that we do have and make it an attractive profession so others can enter into it. And it's only if we look after our health services that we're going to have a growing economy, because you can't have a growing economy if your workforce is really, really ill. So it's an investment that is worth making. And I really hope the government steps up to the plate, takes the negotiations seriously, offers a fair pay deal, and then tries to head off these strikes.
One thing that you have been involved in is to do with health, once again, is the Evusheld. In Parliament, you've continued your work obtaining this for 500,000 clinically vulnerable people who are still at risk from COVID. Their COVID experience is not yet over. How disappointed are you at the progress? Because since we last spoke, nothing much seems to have changed.
You're right. And this is really devastating for these people. You know, 500,000 people who have now been shielding for, you know, 2.5 years, they're now facing their third winter, their third Christmas of shielding. Many of them will be spending Christmas completely on their own. Others will only be spending it with family if their family members have been shielding for several days beforehand. And I just think it is an appalling situation. You know, there's a phrase which says that you can judge a country by the way it treats its most vulnerable people. And if that's the case, then this country's got a lot to answer for, particularly this government has. There is this drug, Evusheld, which has been proven through many studies, both in this country and abroad, which shows this is a drug that can prevent very vulnerable, clinically vulnerable people from catching COVID or from suffering severe consequences from it. It's in use in more than 30 other countries around the world. You know, last time we spoke, you know, I told you about the debate that I held. I asked the government to speed everything up. They made some various commitments, but then there was another reshuffle, right? We're on our sort of second or third reshuffle this year. I've lost count of the number that there have been. And we've got another new minister. And that means the process of lobbying starts all over again to make the case that the government has got to, again, once again, has got to step up and protect people. This drug is not very expensive. It's a lot cheaper than somebody catching COVID and being on on the ICU clinic, for example, in intensive care. The evidence is there, the data is there, it's not very expensive, and the government seems to be quibbling with it. So the only update that there is that NICE, which is the body that looks at the cost effectiveness of drugs, Has said it's going to try and speed up its assessment process. I'm a little bit concerned about how it's going to do that because there's one particular section where they're supposed to look at external evidence and they've taken that bit out. So we'll see how that goes. I've asked the government to roll out antibody testing for these 500,000 people so they actually have some. So they actually have some information about their level of risk, and the government hasn't even managed to do that. So it really is desperate for these 500,000 people, and many of them just say to me they feel like they've been left to rot.
Let's turn it to something positive now. And in the local area, you've been successful with your annual fundraiser. You've already helped raise £10,000 for the St. Albans and District Food Bank. Which other great causes will you be supporting this Christmas?
Well, first of all, can I just please say thank you to everybody who donated to this? I think it's gone up to about 13,000 now, actually. We've had to close the appeal because we think it's right that other charities can benefit. But people in St. Albans have been incredibly generous. And I had a little look through the list and most donations were £10, £20, sort of smaller numbers. And I think that just speaks to the generosity of people in St. Albans, and what their generous donations will do, it will enable people who do rely on the food bank or who need support this Christmas to have fresh fruit and vegetable and a few Christmas treats like biscuits and cheese and things like that. So I'm really pleased that we're able to help. In terms of sort of other good causes, I haven't picked another good cause yet. I will pick one soon, but there are loads in St. Albans. So if anybody is looking for a charity to support, we've got obviously the Women's Refuge, which is very important because we have seen increasing rates of domestic violence during the cost of living crisis. We've got Youth Talk, for example, which is a fantastic local St. Albans charity supporting young people with mental health. We've got the Hygiene Bank, which is similar to the food bank, but provides shower gel and soap and shampoo and things like that. And the lovely little charity called Small Acts of Kindness, who deliver bags of sort of woolly clothes and woolly socks to older people in our district and beyond. So those are just a few that I would encourage people to consider if they want to make another Christmas donation.
Well, hopefully we see more coming together during this Christmas period because it helps improve the whole of the area. Another positive is that you are backing British Farming Day. Which bits of local produce would you say were your favourites, or do you not want to commit to a favourite to not offend anybody? Is there any that you'd like to highlight?
I'm very conscious that with the climate crisis, I'm trying to sort of, and I have done, I've reduced my intake of beef. I've done that over the last 2 or 3 years. When I'm cooking at home, if I buy meat from the supermarket, I tend to use turkey rather than beef. But when I go out to eat, I do really like local produce from two particular farms. There's Hedges Farm, of course, which has a really lovely local sustainable food production, and also Hammond's Farm, which is up in Harpenden as well. So if I'm going to have meat for a meal, I'll try and look for food from Hedges Farm or Hammond's Farm. But we've got lots of other lovely bits as well. So yeah, there's loads of great produce in St. Albans. It'd be quite hard to single out anybody else, I think.
Is that where you'll get your Christmas turkey from, if you eat Christmas turkey?
My husband cooks Christmas lunch, so you have to ask him where he's buying stuff from.
Okay, well, we'll have to
ask. He's the chef in the household.
Let's turn our attention to, though, HSBC, one of the local banks. It's announced that 114 branches will close next year, with some of them being in the Hertfordshire area. Are you a bit worried about banking accessibility for issues for local people?
Yeah, this is a worry. I mean, I think for the vast majority of people now, we're so used to just paying for everything on our cards. We're used to, buying things with a couple of swipes or something online. And, many of us often go and leave the house without any cash and come home without any cash. We just, for a lot of people, we are living in a cashless society. But there are some people who do still depend on having cash. And that can be for various reasons. Often it's because people are either older and are not comfortable using online payment, or it could be because people have particular disabilities as well, and they find it hard to use technology and therefore find it easier to use cash. And for those people who do rely on cash, it is important that they're able to access that money from somewhere. And we are, you know, sort of okay in St Albans with the number of cash points that we have. I think it's very problematic when there are charges for using those cash points, because that means if all somebody has in their bank account is £20 and it costs them, you know, £2 to get that money out, they're losing, you know, quite a lot of their money as a percentage. So I am concerned about it. There's a campaign called Access to Cash, which is a national campaign, which I do support. As I say, for most people, this won't be a worry, but for a small number of our more vulnerable constituents, it is definitely a worry for them.
Let's turn it to the community questions then. And Andrew has opened it up with a question that I have discussed with BIM, and we will discuss with Bambos as well. But he's highlighted the local news story that has nationwide repercussions. This was the arrest of journalists by Hertfordshire Police whilst they were covering the M25 process. He's asked, why did this happen? And will you make sure that something similar will not occur again?
Yeah, this was absolutely shocking. So for those who may not be familiar, there was the Just Stop Oil protest on the M25. The police were rightly called to remove those protesters from the road, who were, you know, quite frankly, engaged in very dangerous behaviour. And some journalists came along to report on what was happening. This happened over a number of days, because there was one day where two male journalists were arrested, and the next day it was a female journalist. So it wasn't a one-off incident. It happened over, you know, on at least a couple of occasions. But as regards the female journalist, you know, she says that she showed her press card. And quite frankly, that should have been the end of the matter. As soon as the police said, who are you and what are you doing here? When you show your press card, you should be left alone. But that isn't what happened. The Hertfordshire Police not only arrested her, they took her to a prison cell. They left her there overnight. They took her DNA. Incredibly intrusive. And there must have been many, many officers involved at different stages of this whole process. It was completely the wrong thing to do. I immediately asked for a full investigation into this. The police have said that they have conducted a sort of short investigation, or at least an investigation was done by a neighbouring force, I believe. And they kind of indicated that they've changed their processes. They're going to provide some training to inexperienced officers, and basically there's nothing to see here. I don't think that's the case. I'm deeply concerned. We've heard about this happening in other places around the country. And I'm going to be meeting with the police soon to put to them a number of questions that I have around how many officers were involved, you know, at what point any of them checked these credentials, what training has or hasn't been provided, and what is going to be done. I think more to the point, what also concerned me was the Police and Crime Commissioner for Hertfordshire, whose duty it is to hold the police to account on behalf of the public, appeared in his interviews not to be holding the police to account, but to be backing up the police and actually challenging news outlets to actually change their own editorial policies, suggesting they shouldn't be covering the protests in the first place. I think that that was at best clumsy, but at worst deeply authoritarian. It is not the role of elected politicians to tell the press how to do their job. The press, we have a free press in this country, and the press are entitled to report on whatever they like, subject to the laws of the land. But also the police have to do their job subject to the laws of the land. And I hope that we see a significant change within Hertfordshire Police on this matter.
Now, one issue that we haven't had clear messaging on as of yet, Malcolm has asked, is the Watford Hospital project cancelled due to austerity?
I really, really hope not. We know when the government announced its budget, the Chancellor did say that the what's called the New Hospitals Programme, which is the programme that's going to deliver the so-called 40 new hospitals, was going to be protected. But when my team and I looked at the details in the budget, it appeared as though quite a lot of money in the particular budget line for capital spend, this is the money on building buildings, building hospitals, that money has been reduced for the next financial year. And that raises significant questions about whether some of these projects will either be delayed or potentially cancelled or merged with each other somehow. So it's really not clear yet. I wrote, I mean, here in Hertfordshire, West Hertfordshire, our hospital services have been, overlooked for decades now. The buildings at Watford Hospital are what's called life expired. They're simply, in many cases around the country, simply not safe. So I did write to the government ahead of the budget and asked them to protect funding for our local hospital trust. I also asked them to put our hospital through something called Route One. Route One is when you get on and build and transform the hospitals. Apparently, the government is contemplating something else called Route Two, which is where you get a whole bunch of hospitals and push them through a sort of standardized process, which might reduce some of the procurement costs, but it would slow everything down. We can't afford to have that here in West Hertfordshire. So I've been making the case, and I'll be writing to the government again. I've heard on the grapevine that there could be a sort of a private meeting between ministers and the officials next week. So there might well be some news in the next few weeks.
Okay, we'll keep an eye on that. Also, on medical issues, Ian asked the question, in comparison to the rest of the country, do St Albans doctors have a lower than average number of face-to-face appointments? I never seem to be able to get an appointment.
So first things first, I would encourage Ian to write to me. Because if you're not able to get a face-to-face appointment and you feel as though you really need one, then you should be able to get one. At the moment, the professional advice says that GPs must provide one where there is a clinical need. Obviously, for many of us, we quite like having a phone call from our GP basically to say, can I get this repeat prescription? Or, these are my symptoms, what do you think? Or whatever it might be. But often, people do need a face-to-face appointment, and they should be, they should be able to get one if they need one. So, if Ian could contact me, send me his details, the name of his GP surgery, I can contact the surgery on his behalf if he provides permission to do that. And if we don't get a good response, then I can write to the Integrated Care Board, which is the service that oversees GP practices in our area. In terms of the broader question about national statistics, I simply don't know. I simply don't know how our rates compare. I also think it would be quite hard to compare those figures because often, not always, but often it's people with long-term conditions who often tend to be older who need those face-to-face appointments. And whereas sort of younger people may not necessarily need a face-to-face appointment, they might be happier with either a video call or a phone call. So I think I'd be concerned about comparing apples and pears, but I'm afraid I just don't have that data.
Fair enough. Kathy has asked the question. She said, I was horrified to read that right-wing extremists have been targeting hotels sheltering asylum seekers in Hertfordshire. Have the police been able to offer more protection?
I really welcome her concern. I think all I will say is that I'm aware of this. I'm working very closely with all the relevant local authorities, and we're doing our best to make sure that everybody in St Albans, wherever they might come from in the world, how long they've been in St Albans, are protected and safe.
Let's move it then to the final questions of this year, actually, with you, Daisy. We won't be speaking to you until January, and they're festive themed. So I hope that gets you in the festive mood. But Michelle has started off the questions with, what are the events you're most looking forward to attending during the upcoming festive period?
Oh, what a lovely idea. Lovely question. So I shall be going to some carols in the Abbey, which is always lovely because we have such a beautiful, beautiful cathedral. I'm going to be having my office lunch with my team, which is my opportunity to say thank you to them for their hard work over the course of the year. And if I find time, I might even do a little bit of a Christmas quiz of some kind. Of course, we have Hanukkah as well at this time of year, the Jewish Festival of Lights. And I'll certainly be able to make, I think, one of those ceremonies this year. So there's a few sort of Christmassy things that I'll be taking part in and hopefully supporting the Hanukkah light as well. The, what do you call it? The has the lighting. That's it.
And
Lighting ceremony.
in terms of it as well, obviously you work a very busy schedule. You have you're pulled every which way by so many people, and you give so much to the community. But will you now have a bit more time to spend with your family? Because you mentioned your hubby a little bit earlier. He's doing the cooking. Will you have more of an opportunity to enjoy some time with him? Because we know as well from chatting to you. So we've even seen your dedication showed from you postponing your honeymoon. So is this going to be a good time to you two to have some time together?
Yes, I hope so. I mean, as well as doing the cooking on Christmas Day, and my husband has been working on a huge project recently as well. So he's been really up against it, and he'll definitely need a break. So I'm hoping that over the festive period, we'll be able to have a little bit of time out, maybe have a drink or two in the local pubs, enjoy our park, and enjoy the festive period in St Albans.
A gin or two.
Possibly. Let's see how we go.
And the final question for this year, and the final Christmas question as well, is from Colin. He said, with Christmas coming up soon, are there any books you can recommend for the festive period?
Well, given the state of our politics and the absolute mess that we've had in Westminster for the last 10 or 11 months, I'm going to recommend that people read the book Why We Get the Wrong Politicians.
That sounds a lovely recommendation. I might pick it up as well because obviously I love the politics. But Daisy, it has been great to chat to you today. I hope people in the area have enjoyed listening and found your answers useful. But for now, I'm going to wish you the best of health, the best of luck, and also have a fantastic Christmas period.
Thank you, and you.